Thank you. I appreciate Chairman Pashu and Chairman Hood invite me to speak with you today. This is one of my most favorite topics, and I'd like to cover it over the next 25 minutes. Cotton growers, as we've heard from the speakers this morning, obviously have long and short-term challenges that they have to face. At Cotton Corporate, we're very fortunate that you've granted us some flexibility to look a little bit more at the long-term challenges. And so this morning, I'm going to share with you not only my observations about varieties and germplasm, but also some of the Cotton Corporate efforts in that area. Just briefly, before I get into variety improvement, I want to talk a little bit about the efforts at Ag Research Cotton Incorporated from a major initiative standpoint, because we have a lot of activity going on, but we really try to explain what we do at Ag Research based around some major initiatives. Obviously, sustainability that Barry mentioned, resistance management of keeping the tools we have effective, economics and farm profitability is important to everyone. Innovative machinery, evaluating some of those. And I put that in blue deliberately because it's hard to choose any other colors there, but we all know that that's an important part. It will be covered later on this morning. Precision cotton is a key component of trying to identify the inputs that are applied at the right rate, at the right time, to the right part of the field for maximum profit. Successional pest is something that Pat O'Leary leads for us, and that's an issue of looking at the changes in our production systems and trying to anticipate and address the new pests that crop up because of changes. Obviously, gin byproduct value is a big part of Tom Weedegardner's program, as is cottonseed value, and variety improvement is one that several of us work on. So I would like to start out by asking you to think about variety improvement in a different way than what we've done in the past. Clearly, growers and consultants think about variety improvement the way that that John mentioned on the introduction as a critical component of the decisions that we take over the next couple months. Seed companies, where I've come from just recently, think about it a little bit differently. They see it as the variety improvement is the long-term component of their financial health. And they've learned that brand loyalty doesn't extend any further than wearing a free cap. And certainly a competitive lead lasts only as long as another variety can be increased, which with the new technologies we have, within a year you can blow up seed very rapidly, so the varieties can be very responsive to the marketplace. What I'd like you to do is think about variety improvement as a long-term cornerstone of cotton's competitiveness, not only in yield, but also in consumer demand. And that's what I'd like to try to convince you of this morning. I'll be talking about opportunities, fiber yield, fiber quality, and then hitting on some of the challenges that we have in variety improvement. Obviously, the opportunities were well addressed by Gary Gadams earlier, and I just wanted to reiterate this with a great slide courtesy of Neil Forrester that really shows the hundreds of millions of children and adults that are coming out of poverty around the world, and that these consumers will demand better food, better textiles, more garments, and that's a huge opportunity to supply that with cotton. Cotton is the fiber that we want them to wear. They want to wear that. As you can see, most of these children are wearing cotton. It's a huge opportunity for us, but it's also one that is a very long-term opportunity. It's one that requires a lot of adjustments over time. It takes approximately 15 years to develop a new product. If we just go through the various steps, and you can see them on the slide, those are the steps in making a new transgenic variety with new traits. It's about a 15-year process. Now, we can shorten it by using an old variety, but even still, we have a 10-year process. Or we can shorten it by producing conventional varieties, and even still, that's a 10-year process. So it takes a very long time to move this, to turn this ship. It takes a long time to respond to market signals as to what we need 15 years into the future. Even the process of testing these products in the field these new transgenic products is a seven-year cycle of approximately. And we see that from the testing that's occurred in the U.S. for the various traits that have been released. These are the biotech products that have been introduced into the U.S. And what the yellow part there shows the number of years that they were field tested prior to the commercial approval, and the gray illustrates the first, second, and third, and fourth commercial approvals around the world. So you can see that it's a 4 to 7 year process just to test these new traits and get them ready for regulatory approval. So it's a very slow process that seed companies are responding to signals from quite a bit into the future. Now we can see how these signals impact the products that we have and partially explain why we don't always have the variety that we want for this year for a particular use that may come up over a short 2, 3, even 5 year period. And I think the U.S. is a very good illustration of that. If you take that look at that bottom line, that's the red line of the bale consumption here in the U.S. And if we think back to the 70s and early 80s, when the bulk of the world's cotton was ring spun, that's what the U.S. was developing products for. Deltafine 50 is a great example. And then as we got into the 80s and early 90s, consumption in the U.S. grew dramatically. But also, you can see that the U.S. added rotor spinning capability. We went from 300,000 spindles to about 1 million spindles over that time period. And that was a technology that encouraged a different type of cotton, one that has greater strength than what's needed for ring spinning. And then over the next cycle, we've seen that the U.S., obviously, the demand or consumption of cotton has gone down along with the spinning capabilities, while at the same time, China, which is the top line there, the blue line, that shows that their consumption has just increased dramatically while they've added a tremendous number of ring spinning. So we've gone from being focused on ring to rotor to ring back again. Signals that have occurred very rapidly and have encouraged the breeding companies to shift focus and to try to respond to those needs. Just as a contrast, we can look at what's happened in California and Australia. And Australia is a very good example of an area where the signals to the breeders have primarily been for export. That top dotted line there is the Australian percent of their crop, which is exported. And you can see just about for the entire existence of that industry, their focus has been on export. Into Asia, which has been primarily ring spinning. So they have a long history of being focused on the ring spun market. These signals that come from the marketplace for different types of cotton, we can look at those from a scientific standpoint in trying to understand what the quality parameters that are needed for those different spinning types. Some work of collaborative with Dr. Mogazzi and Mike Watson, looking at the relative importance of different fiber parameters for either ring spinning and rotor spinning. And you can see the yellow area represents the importance for rotor spinning and the strong impact of fiber strength. It's the HS there on the right, and also micronair. We know that rotor spinning is the construction of the yarn is not as robust as a ring spun yarn, and so it's really important that we have a large number of fibers in the cross section, and it's also important that those fibers be as strong as possible. But you can see in that yellow area a greatly reduced emphasis on the fiber length, or FL, at the top. And we contrast that with ring spinning, and we see that it's fiber length, which is the driver in terms of the value or the ability of high-quality fiber to translate into high-quality yarn. You can see fiber length is the most important here, and that's because with the twists which are added to the ring-spun yarn, the longer the fiber it is, the more twists that fiber will persist through from one twist to the next. Having individual fibers persist through there is very important. And obviously the corollary of that is the short fiber content way down at the lower right. And you can see the FFC is very important for ring spun yarn just for the same reason. Now, if we look at the signals which we're receiving right now, the way that Mike Watson at Cotton Incorporated sorts these out is by looking at the three major types of yarn which is demanded for the world and the different fiber requirements that for either fine, medium, or coarse spun, and obviously our fine count yarns need all of these parameters above in terms of the traditional parameters we look at, while a coarse count will require parameters in this level, and then obviously the medium is what's left. So if we look at the what is the world's demand or utilization for cotton fiber at this point, we can see that 35% to 40% is for fine count yarns for this type of fiber. And if we look at the other demand, we can see that the coarse count is 40% to 45%. So that obviously it doesn't leave a whole lot for what's in the middle, what might cause the donut. The donut hole has been taken out of the demand. And so the world's demand for that medium type of cotton has been on the decline, and historically that's the one that that the U.S. has produced a fair amount in the Mid-South. So obviously these are signals that are being sent through the marketplace, but also we need to look at it from a textile industry as well. I'd like to talk a little bit about yields and varieties, and we've heard from Gary the situation on the yields this year. And just to illustrate from a color standpoint, because we'll look at it on a region-by-region issue, we can see that obviously the greens, we had outstanding versus disappointing yields in the Southeast. And how if we look at those different yield outstanding versus disappointing parameters, if we look at that, how it impacts fiber quality, we can see that we're very fortunate in that we were able to sustain excellent fiber quality on average. There's fields that obviously had and counties that had issues, but if you look at the severe yield loss area, these are the classing offices, and the way we're reporting this is each of those dots represents a different year. So the green dots represents the results from 2007, and you can see that we dropped off a little bit in terms of fiber strength where we had those low yields with a severe stress, and we obviously were able to push up the fiber strength dramatically in those areas where we had significant yield gains. So we're seeing that quality is responding favorably to good growing conditions, but it's not being hurt too much from the standpoint of the stress. And again, if we look at the impact on fiber length, we can see that we have favorable conditions where we had significant yield gains, and we were down a little bit where we had yield loss. But overall, I was really, really pleased to see that the fiber quality, despite very severe stress across the Southeast, was relatively limited in terms of total number of bales. Very interesting is the Dumas, Arkansas, and I'll just go back to the previous slide and look at how all the dots are on top of each other for Dumas, Arkansas. And then if you look at for length, again, they're pretty much on top of there. Something unusual is happening in Dumas, Arkansas in terms of the stability of the fiber from year to year. And you can see that Dumas is sitting right in the middle of another major irrigated patch. In our discussions on sustainability, we talk about this quite a bit, because even though that's a high percentage of the area which has the capability of being irrigated, this is supplemental irrigation, and it has the ability to provide supplemental irrigation to rainfall, which is a very positive characteristic for not only yield stability but also for fiber stability, and something that a significant amount of the U.S. has benefited from, and obviously a real challenge for the Southeast is the lack of the ability to apply supplemental irrigation for stability of yield and fiber quality. So despite that lack of irrigation and the stability that it offers for yields and fiber quality, it's remarkable that we've had the success, the industry and the growers have had the success over the last 10 years, pushing steadily up yield, length, and strength. And it's not unusual that we'd expect them to move in tandem, because if we've seen that with the impact of stress. What's really remarkable is, despite some extremely tough weather, and actually cotton moving to what historically was a lower yielding state or part of the U.S., it's a remarkable story that we have continued to march upward with all those important parameters. Let's look a little bit at yield in relationship to germplasm and variety improvement. And certainly the long-term trend is upward in terms of in yield across the U.S. 8.4 pounds per acre is just sort of a steady march upward in terms of yield. But if we look at focused areas of the U.S., we can see the phenomenal story that's happened in Texas. And I have to admit that I was one of the agronomists that in the early 90s when I worked there that really missed the advantage of full season varieties. And I have to compliment the Texas industry for driving forward in testing and developing production practices to make full season varieties work, particularly in West Texas. The management skills to make that work were not easy, and whether it's harvest aids or growth regulation or fertility or supplemental irrigation, and I compliment Texas for that dramatic improvement in their profitability in terms of yield. From a variety contribution to yield, I think the best summary of this was done by Dr. Tom Kirby for the Bremen Conference. And what he's done is he's looked at how the variety contributes to yield based on when that variety was released. And the important part of this curve is you can see we are fairly flat for the bulk of the time period, that germplasm releases contributed fairly little, about 3 to 3.2 pounds per year to increase. But the last 10 years has been a phenomenal, where Tom calculates about 14.7, 15 pounds per acre per year increase from germplasm. So the germplasm has had a big part of a yield increase over the last 10 years, but it hasn't explained all of what's happened. We look at that same 10-year period, and we can see that the historic level is 8 pounds, a fairly flat. The germplasm level that Tom talks about is 15 pounds, but actually we have achieved a 31-pound increase over that last 10 years, just about double of what we would expect from the germplasm. And so I had an opportunity to talk with some of our other staff about where this comes from. And if we just go through the math of 31 pounds actual for 10 years, 15 pounds from germplasm, leaves about 16 pounds per year from other sources. And where has this come from? Is this weather? Is this climate change? Actually, I hope not. If the climate is changing so fast that we see that kind of change in 10 years, then we've got a really rough ride ahead of us. I think your increase in irrigation capacity has certainly helped, but I think management skills and tools that farmers have increased dramatically over the last 10 years. Crop management skills, as I mentioned, the ability to take a full-season variety and grow it north of Lubbock is truly impressive from a skill standpoint. Boll weevil eradication, the growth in biotech acres, particularly the BT cotton that protects it season-long. But also an issue that the Roy Cantrell brought up is that grower expertise with specific germplasm. Growers have really learned how to zero in on varieties and modify their production practices for specific products. And I think that's a substantial change where we've seen some stability in germplasm that has allowed growers to really refine what works best for a variety on a particular field. Now, that's not all good. There's some challenges that we'll talk about that in just a second. I'd like to move now into challenges, and obviously one of the key challenges in the long term is climate related issues. And here we see that variety improvement for farmers is the best way that they can mitigate damage from climate change. They need options in terms of germplasm and seed and variety types and various stress tolerances to be able to address that. But I think that's an area that the seed industry can play a major role. Ex-US, I think, has the chance, particularly of cotton, of being hit fairly hard. The tropics is the area that they're forecast to suffer the most with slight increase in warming. I think the U.S. is positioned much better because it's more temperate, but it's robust seed industry and it's irrigated acres. Another major challenge is what was talked about with Gary Adams, with the India increase in their yields per acre has just been a phenomenal. Where are they going to go? Obviously, they have more BT acreage to adopt, improved agronomics, higher densities. Right now the bulk of the Indian crop is planted at a very low density, and you've got the whole family looking at every single plant. You know, if they doubled their seeding rate, their planting rate, I think that would also have an impact on what they're doing. A major challenge is glyphosate tolerance, and the next speaker will cover this in detail. I think that's a huge one that that weed scientists are working vigorously trying to address. A moderate challenge is the genetic diversity. We've seen good genetic diversity from one variety to another as breeders reach deep into their pocket and across the world for breeding material. But as you can see by extending Daryl Bowman's data, that currently we have a couple major products that occupy a lot of acreage in the southeast and southwest. And those that poses some potential risk from a disease standpoint. I'd like to just close by talking a little bit about Cotton Incorporated's program to support varieties. It's a major initiative of ours. We put a lot of effort to try to ensure that we have germplasm and breeding tools and innovation coming along in the breeding. And I'll just highlight a couple of those. Germplasm releases through the public sector, we've have a long history of supporting those, and those can go into transgenic products, conventional products, and further breeding canes. I think the biggest breakthrough was the reniform resistance that's come out of Dr. Stelly's lab. A tremendous ability to pull genes out of a diploid, out of a wild species, and make them available for cotton. Just a phenomenal success. And let me just wrap up by going back to an article that was in the New York Times this Sunday, looking at what happened to Amazon over the history of their life and their focus on service. The title was "Put Buyers First." What a concept! And I think we can apply that to cotton in this slight downturn in acres. It's not going to obviously be the kind of dip that the dot-com experienced. But this gives us a real opportunity to do two things. And one is to really focus on our product efficiency. That's utilizing inputs, that's cotton flow, the National Cotton Council is focused on, and it's also yields. But also we need to make sure that the product that we're producing is optimum for our customers, both our direct customers, those that buy the cotton for the mills, but our long-term customer, which is the consumer of our textile garments. Thank you very much. John, I'll turn it back to you. Thank you.
Appreciate it.